Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. We hope we can get you juiced this morning to talk about art like we do every other Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We want to pass on that WOWD, WOWD, was voted number two radio station in Washington, D.C. by the Washington City Papers readership voters. We are WOWD and we are proud. We've done a lot of hard work in the last 20 months or so, and it's a way to go. We couldn't thank you enough being our listeners. This is Tom Sinakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we're the host of the Artist Experience radio program.
Good morning. Hi. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you, if you visit the exhibit, to create in your soul, in your own experience, your own work of art. And our mission here is to demystify art so that everybody has a little background and comfort. So we also have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. So please look at it if you can while you're listening. You can also stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, and on ArtAsExperience.com, so you can listen anytime. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes.
Well, happy Cinco de Mayo, everyone. In Mexico, it's Cinco de Mayo, and same here. But it's actually celebrated a little differently in America, with a little more American merriment to it. It's really a celebration of the Mexican victory over the French at the Battle of Puebla on May 5th, 1862. That holiday is celebrated in various different ways in various parts of Mexico. But in America, it's really more a holiday about Mexican-American culture. Well, one of the great joys of doing this program is finding that we find these new venues of art and culture in the city. And, you know, we're not familiar with everything, and we thought, Sheila, we thought we were culture
yeah,
vultures.
We did.
And we are not. Well, Sheila and I want to thank our friend Christina, who mentioned a real gem in the city that we've dedicated this program to. So we dedicate this program to you, Christina, and also we dedicate our show to sharing with our listeners about the Mexican Cultural Institute, an incredible gem in the heart of D.C. The Mexican Cultural Institute is in Columbia Heights at 2829 16th Street, Northwest in D.C. It's metro accessible with a little walk from the Georgia Avenue Petler Station and other locations and walking distance with bus service as well. Parking can be a bit difficult in the neighborhood, but it's certainly worth it. The Institute is open from Monday to Friday at 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Saturdays from 12 to 4. And it has several exhibitions. Please see the website, as there are a host of opportunities for tours of groups of various kinds and cultural activities throughout the year. See www.instituteofamexicodc.org. This is a fabulous place and a real treasure. Investigating culture is a great journey which expands our horizons and fills us with new avenues of discovery about a people, a place, possibly a long history that goes with it. In this case, a rich history that has bordered the USA in many configurations over the century, and that's Mexico. We have a lot to say about this cultural heritage and an oasis for Mexican culture right here in D.C. That's where we're going to go today, Sheila. So give us a little mini crash course in the rich cultural art history of Mexico.
Okay, but first of all, I have to ask all of you listeners to forgive my Spanish, of which I really am just winging it. I got a little tutoring.
We will forgive you.
Thank
we
you.
We promise.
Thank you. I'm going to do my best. So I'm going to try to give you all a crash course in the Mexican visual arts history. Mexico's long tradition of graphic arts goes back to pre-Columbian times. And pre-Columbian times go way back to 8,000 B.C., these were complex civilizations that were conquered and colonized by the Spanish in the 16th century. Pre-Columbian Mexico is one of the seven cradles of civilization. There were several tribes, for example, the Olmec, Toltec, Teotihuacan, Zapotec, Maya, and Aztec. One of the important aspects of the Mesoamerican civilizations was their development of a form of writing, so that Mexico's written history stretches back hundreds of years before the arrival of the Spaniards in 1519. The earliest human artifacts in Mexico are chips of stone tools found near campfire remains in the Valley of Mexico, and they are radiocarbon dated to about 10,000 years ago. So that's a history which is documented. Mexico is the site of the domestication of maize, tomatoes, and beans, which produced an agricultural surplus. A surplus is what enabled the transition from the Paleolithic hunter-gatherers to agricultural villages around 5000 BC, which led to a mythological and religious complex with priests and scribes and a numeric system. Mesoamerica, along with Mesopotamia and China, are the three known places in the world where writing developed independently, along with art, architecture, mathematics, a calendar, and an astronomical system. So in 2013, there were 5,000 paintings, cave paintings, found in the Baja Peninsula, and they're not even finished discovering because the terrain is very difficult there, and there are obviously more caves to be discovered.
Well, I never even heard of this.
I know. They're remarkable for their completeness. Their layered images, petroglyphs or cave paintings, may be expressive and graceful drawing, but they could be, or they could just be like ancient graffiti. But these Baja paintings are closer to Rembrandt than graffiti. The difference is the completeness of these visions. And really, I hope that you look on our Facebook page and look at some of these absolutely marvelous, marvelous cave paintings. And let's not forget the pyramids. The Mesoamerican pyramids form a prominent part of ancient Mesoamerican architecture. They're similar in shape or form, but these structures bear only a very weak architectural resemblance to the Egyptian pyramids. The Mesoamerican examples are usually step pyramids with temples on top, more like the ziggurats of Mesopotamia. Mesoamerican region's largest pyramid by volume, the largest in the world by volume, is the Great Pyramid of Cholula. Some classic Mesoamerican pyramids are covered with stories about the hero twins and the feathered serpent Quetzalcoatl, the creation myths, ritualistic sacrifice, all written in the form of hieroglyphs on the rises of the steps of the pyramids and on the walls and on the sculpture. It seems like just as the Mayans invented math, for the indigenous tribes, mural painting was in their blood. The Mayans are widely considered to be pre-Columbian America's most brilliant civilization. They thrived between approximately 250 and 900 AD. They developed a calendar and a writing system and built cities that functioned as hubs for the surrounding farming towns. Jared Diamond recently wrote about the causes of the collapse of the Mayan civilization in 900 AD. It was an ecological devastation. Their farming practices destroyed the groundwater, and which was the basis of their agriculture. The Spanish conquest of the Aztec Empire began in 1519 when Hernan Cortes arrived at the port of Veracruz with about 500 conquistadors. He was searching for gold and other riches, and Cortes decided to invade and conquer the Aztec Empire. So after taking control of Veracruz, he moved on to the Aztec capital. Smallpox was their unintentional ally. Smallpox was endemic among the soldiers, but the natives had no immunity, and the infectious disease ravaged Mesoamerica in the 1520s. It killed maybe as many as 15 million out of a population of less than 30 million. At first, the Aztecs believed the epidemic was a punishment from an angry god, but they later accepted their fate and no longer resisted the Spanish rule. Many of the surviving Aztecs believed that smallpox could be credited to the superiority of the Christian god, which resulted in their acceptance of Catholicism and yielding to the Spanish rule throughout Mexico. Spanish is the language of Mexico. Catholicism is the religion. The most important icon of Mexican national culture is the Virgin of Guadalupe, which illustrates the pervasive influence of Roman Catholicism in the national culture. She is viewed as the mother of all Mexicans. So after 300 years of wars in 1821, after the Mexican War of Independence, Mexico became its current nation. There was and is great economic disparity. After many wars spurred on by the doctrine of manifest destiny, the U.S. acquired eventually California, Nevada, Utah, the rest of Colorado, as well as most of northern New Mexico, Arizona, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming. By the end of the 20th century, Mexico was the United States' second largest trading partner, a key member of the three-state North America Free Trade Agreement, the source of millions of immigrants to the United States, and a thorn in the side of Washington when it came to border crime, drug trafficking, corruption. Because of this, the current administration is intent on erasing our long friendship with Mexico and is instituting draconian laws to separate our interconnected nations.
Well, thank you for that, Sheila. Well, guys, I mean, I suddenly have this amazing radio tickle in my throat. Oh. I don't know. We got to get through this. Well, you know, it's interesting how we're exposed to culture. You know, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and living in the city, you might think that I've been was exposed to Mexican culture as a child, but I surely was not. And I can honestly say I never met a person of Mexican extraction ever, even ate Mexican food. I can't even remember a Mexican restaurant in that part of Brooklyn where I grew up. So it's amazing how you kind of get invited to a culture. And my invitation was at the Brooklyn Museum. And I certainly remember Olmec sculpture and pre-Columbian art and the art of the Maya and Aztecs. This I remember clearly also as my aunt and uncle got a turquoise Mayan calendar in one of their trips to Mexico. And I was absolutely totally fascinated by this calendar. And so it was introduced to this Mexican culture through centuries of art splendor. This kind of art immortality lives in Mexico, and we talked about immortality and art in our last show. Well, also, the 1968 Summer Olympic Games in Mexico City was another important introduction to Mexican culture to me and my family. And it was kind of, you know, exciting because we were always excited about the Olympics. The Mexico City Olympics was the first of its kind in Latin America and introduced the world to the vibrancy of Mexico City and its culture in Mexico in general. These Olympic Games opened up a new world for me as I was enthralled by the artful nature of the venues, incorporating their art and culture. I was young, but it left an amazing impression. This is the same Olympics where American medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fist in Black Power solidarity, protesting the South African apartheid and the civil rights in the U.S. at that same time. So it had a dual meaning and memory for me. Mexico has evolved, and the Mexican Cultural Institute here in D.C. is a place to get reacquainted and experience the old and the new in a cultural relationship that's centuries old. What was your introduction to Mexican culture, Sheila? I'm just dying to know because I feel so uninformed and foggy about it.
Same boat as you. Okay, here's my first one. Viva Zapata. It was a movie that was made in 1952 when I was starting to get crushes on movie stars. And that Marlon Brando, he was playing the revolutionary Emiliano Zapata, and he's on a horse with a white blouse, raising a flag, saying, Viva Zapata! So that was my first one. The second one was when I was 23 and pregnant, and I had to get unmarried and marry somebody else. So I flew to El Paso, Texas, to get a divorce in Juarez.
Wow, thanks for sharing
that
one.
That was a good one. Well, and another one is recently a vacation my family took at a resort, and we were so trapped in that resort, but we rented a car, my son and Peter and me, and we had a nest of ants under the floorboards. So we were like dodging the ants, and we saw not very colorful poverty, I have to say. And then we had lunch in a beautiful 16th century colonial city, Valladolid. and we climbed the pyramid at the Mayan city, Coba. And then there's the story I told a couple of weeks ago about the artist Leonor Carrington, who is a painter and lived in Mexico and now has a museum dedicated to her work.
Yes, and I've learned so much about, you know, artists and cultures from you, Sheila, and I really thank you for that in our interactions here on the station. Talk a little about the Mexican Institute proper.
Sure. Okay, so the Mexican Cultural Institute is the cultural arm of the Embassy of Mexico. It's an organization that's committed to enriching the relationship between Mexico and the United States, and it shares its rich culture, the past, and the present with the local community. Since 1990, this edifice has hosted ongoing cultural programs with a wide range of cultural variety from the diverse nature of the Mexican peoples and traditions in many art genres. The programs include art exhibitions, historical exhibitions, conferences, lectures, film, music, culinary events, and educational outreach. The Institute has created strong partnerships with other important art venues in DC, such as the Smithsonian Institution, the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, the National Gallery of Art, the Library of Congress, the American Film Institute, and American University. There's constantly something happening there, and it is one beautiful setting.
And no, it's on 16th mm-hmm. Street, which is a really nice street anyway, and there are these gorgeous buildings, they're places of worship, there's other kind of mansions on the street, and this building really is amazing. In 1910, the Secretary of the Treasury, Franklin McVeigh, with his wife, commissioned architect Nathan C. Wyatt to design this mansion, and stately it is, just like mansions.
Yeah, well, this may or may not be true, but it sounds great, is that the building was a secret Christmas present from Emily McVeigh that she gave to her husband, Franklin. I hope that was true. It
might
have been
nice
a little
present.
Bit hard to hide it, you know, and put the bow on it, too. But Emily McVeigh wanted to develop the mansions on Meridian Hill to compete with the mansions in Kalorama.
Well, this building has classic grandeur from Renaissance Revival styles that were very much in vogue at the time. In 1921, the post-revolutionary government of President Alvaro Obregón purchased the McVeigh Mansion to house the Embassy of Mexico. Mexico's diplomatic relations with the U.S. was conducted from this location over the next 69 years, making it a symbol of the bridges of understanding and friendship between the two neighboring countries. In 1990, the embassy was turned over into the Cultural Institute of Mexico, and the embassy and residency were located in another part of D.C. There are some amazing rooms in this mansion with a variety of flavors that echo the cultural diversity within Mexico. As you walk, you know, your eyes go right up to this incredible stairwell, and there are these murals there, and they go up and up and up in the building. These works represent a powerful part of the artistic legacy of Mexican mural paintings from the 1920s on. We have talked about Diego Rivera, Orozco, Sagueras, when we talked about the Mexican Revolution in political art. That was one of our fun shows where we actually introduced some Mexican art. So here in D.C., we have a treat to the murals of Roberto Cueva del Rio, who was recommended by Diego Rivera to take on this fabulous commission. He must have been really in good stead because Diego Rivera was a tough critic.
Mm-hmm.
These murals of various historical important moments in Mexican history are magnificent in scale, visual power, and color. These works successfully portray the flavor of Mexico and the visual language of the culture through the mural arts.
Mm. Well, the walls of the house are covered with murals. They're full of activity and color, and the murals depict the brutal history of Mexico. Mexico has had a tradition of painting murals, starting with the Olmec civilization in the pre-Hispanic period and into the colonial period, with murals mostly painted to evangelize and reinforce Christian doctrine. Only I would go further and say that the beautiful cave paintings that I spoke about before are in the blood, just as the Mayans had mathematics in their blood, the indigenous Mexicans had murals in their blood.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. Mm.
The modern tradition had its roots in the 19th century, and with this use of political and social themes, the first Mexican mural painter to use philosophical themes in his work was Juan Cordero in the mid-19th century, and he painted mostly for the church. Diego Rivera, Jose Clemente Orozco, and David Seguros, from the 1920s to about the 1970s, painted a large number of murals with nationalistic, social, and political messages. They were created on public buildings. They were sometimes funded by the government. And they started a tradition that continues to this day in Mexico. And it's had an impact in other parts of the Americas too, including the United States, where it served as inspiration for the Chicano art movement. The Mexican government, in a successful attempt to enhance the mansion's splendor, added a portico to the Italian-style facade. The interior of this magnificent mansion has aesthetically integrated and combined different types, styles, and shapes, reflecting the dynamics of a Mexican culture. Thus, the main hall, which is inspired by late 15th century Italian architecture, is a majestic setting for the mahogany English banister and 18th century Mexican altarpiece. So all of this is combined, and somehow it works in its richness. You wouldn't expect to see a home of this grandeur and filled with these really historical murals. The three-story mural by Roberto Cueva del Rio provides a breathtaking backdrop to this grand entrance hall. So Roberto Cueva del Rio was born in 1908. His family moved to Mexico City when he was a child, and there when he was 15, he became an illustrator. His newspaper caricatures won him a scholarship to the prestigious San Carlos Academy of Fine Arts in Mexico City, which permitted him to travel through Mexico. And he exhibited his drawings and caricatures in one-man shows and painted murals for public schools and in private homes. In January 1930, Diego Rivera, who was then director of the academy, gave him an effusive letter of recommendation to support his successful application to travel to the United States. He was described as an exceptionally humble, although legitimately ambitious young man who expresses relief after being offered two important commissions that he will finally be able to send money home to his mother. Cueva del Rio began the embassy murals in 1933, but he left them unfinished and returned to Mexico in 1935 to paint murals in numerous private residences in Mexico City and also in various public buildings. And then he returned to complete the murals in 1941, and he changed some of his plans. We know, for example, that his historic portrait of Columbus, which is at the top of the stairway leading to the third floor, was originally planned as a portrait of the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes. And Cortes, his historic reputation had done very poorly after the Mexican Revolution, and whose ideals emphasized the achievements of the pre-conquest native civilizations. And Columbus at that time seemed like a better choice.
Yeah, less controversial. That's good. Yeah. Wow, two tough choices there.
Mm-hmm.
This artist, one thing about him, he really captured the style of the Mexican muralists, you know, which had their roots in European painting. I mean, there's mm-hmm. no doubt about that. But he evolved it in the language of the Mexicans and the indigenous people of Mexico. The colors are painted very thinly and layered with great curvilinear expressiveness and motion. It really keeps your eye engaged, these murals. The combinations are beautiful, the ochres, neutral tones, and the blues in the murals are absolutely beautiful. The Mexican mural had its influence way beyond its borders, and it also influenced the American painters of the 1930s and 1940s, mm-hmm. and this is really important because when you think of the mural work of Thomas Hart Benton and other artists working for the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, in the Depression, they really kind of had that flavor of the Mexican murals.
Yes, they did.
And of course, you know, the Rivera and all, they were in and out of the United States, these other Mexican mural painters. But like you said before, the influences of Chicano murals in Southern California and L.A. on both sides of the border were definitely historically important. Excuse me. We're going to take a little break now and listen to a very, very popular tune that's shared by most and known by most in Mexico.
Me gustan a mí, y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM.
Sheila, why don't you talk about some Mexican art that you really love? You're really excited about some Mexican art.
Yeah, Tom, I am so glad that I get a chance to talk about Jamex and Einar de la Torre. Okay, I saw a show in Albuquerque several years ago of these two crazy art school trained artists, and they're like a two-man bi-national renaissance. They're brothers, and they collaborate intensely to create these monumental, partly blown grass multimedia works. And it's very hard to describe, so I hope you'll go on the Facebook page and see if you can see pictures of their work. But their art constantly addresses and questions very complex issues. They love a joke, a visual pun, hidden symbols, and wordplay. For the De La Torre brothers, nothing and everything is sacred, including politics, religion, tradition, and geographical location. They are visually and socially timely, and I'm telling you that irreverent just doesn't cut it. So Einar and Jamex De La Torre have their fingers on the pulse of popular culture, and they peel off layers of the 20th century transnational world. Their edgy creations are fusions of glass, cast resin, popular arts, video, dollar store treasures, and they unmistakably defy designation, and they veer into a new place that might be well known as Border Baroque. This
That's
is a great term.
Yeah.
When I saw that show at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque, I just loved it. The two brothers, they're visual punters, they're excavators of history, and above all things, they're Mexican. So they love a joke, and they go so far that you keep discovering increasingly sacrilegious things like the glass tears flowing from Jesus's eyes. This is one of my main criteria for art, that it extends the viewing experience in time. And if you ever get to see their work, I'm sure you'll see so much beyond what I'm going to describe. If the art curator at the Mexican Cultural Institute is listening, check them out. So one piece I never stop laughing about is a Mexican spaceship landing on the moon. So the craters of the moon are tires sliced in half like bagels. And the body of the ship is a huge Olmec head with bright light blue eyes. And the struts down to the moon's surfaces are like pipes in hubcaps. And there's a terrible little flag planted in one of the tire craters and an astronaut in an Olmec spacesuit with a bubble helmet saluting the trashed American flag. Inside the space capsule, the floor is littered with beer cans and hanging strings of chili peppers. And another piece was a great Mayan pyramid made out of stacked camper tops, which are sort of successively smaller, covered with bright green shag carpeting. And there's so much more in that. There's TV sets and fish bowls. And, oh, my God. So that's the Mayan pyramid. And so while the De La Torre brothers, they were born in Mexico, but their family moved to San Diego. So they really travel back and forth between National City, California, where they have a studio, and Ensenada, Mexico. And they've been called Mexican, American, Californian, Chicano, and Latino. Yet their parallel appreciation of both cultures and personal experiences lead them to create free art that's free of labels, and it feeds their desire to preserve the survival of the possibility of doing something new. I am amazed that we don't see their work here in Washington. Please.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And when art is fun, it could be very important and refreshing, actually.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I wanted to take a little time to talk about the workmanship at the Mexican Cultural Institute and about craftsmanship and craftswomanship. Although a lot of the work that we see was probably not done by Mexican craftspeople at the Mexican Institute, but it conjures up a lot of things related to the murals. The style is in a Renaissance revival, as I said, which does have an Italian and Spanish flavor, and it fits really well with these murals. But I want to mention that sometimes when you go into a mansion, you know how you go into this really stately place, mm-hmm. and you see master craftspersonship, and which is in a host of the decorative arts, which we see at the Mexican Cultural Institute. There's woodworking, tile making, decorative wall painting, masonry. And this kind of skill is echoed in the hard work depicted in these murals. You see basket making, you know, ceramics, painting. You see that imagery in the murals. Mm. And it's, you know, I want to just reflect on this for a minute, that it, you know, it's hard work to make something beautiful. And, you know, Mexico is also a weaving culture that's very rich. And so, you know, we have Mexico, which was traditionally an agrarian society, people working in the fields, farmers toiling in various landscapes, the mountains and the sea, so on and so forth. So the murals echo this physical work and labor. And that's really an important part of Mexican culture. And there is this great wealth in Mexico that is hard work. And it's an integral part of their whole history. And so I sometimes think that, you know, do people appreciate all this kind of craftsmanship or craftswomanship? And the reason I bring it up, because a lot of the great monuments in America, and especially in D.C., were in fact crafted by immigrants. You know, and that's that's something we have to really kind of bang home here. I mean, the, immigrants of all nationalities and flavors actually have enhanced this city, Washington. We have German immigrants, Swiss, Italian, French, and I'm sure, you know, Mexican immigrants in places that have brought their woodworking skills, their metalwork, their masonry skills to construct these great edifices in this capital, Washington. So I think we also have to extend that in the Mexicans that have gone throughout the globe have also brought their craft in basket weaving, in tile making, in ceramics. And I think that's something that we forget. We really forget that these people not only come to America with their skills, but they also want to share them. And that's a powerful thing when you go in the Mexican Institute and you see the imagery on the walls, and then you relate it to the gifts that they've spread. And I think that's an important part of the trip that I got out of our Mexican Cultural Institute experience.
Tom, thank you for that. That was really... Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Sheila.
No, I really mean it. That was great. So I'm going to talk about a room in the house, a very large room at the front of the house, and it was the office of the former ambassador to Mexico, and it's lined with bookshelves on the bottom of the room and with heavy tapestries. So every room in this house is very different in feeling, just like Mexico itself. And in this room, the curtains are drawn, and this room broods of scholarship, and it's clearly a place where the ambassador received mail. They said that, guests, from behind this giant desk, and affairs of importance are discussed. So frequently, American Beaux-Arts houses in a wide variety of historical sites. Styles included walnut or oak paneled and beamed libraries, and this is this in that tradition of English libraries of the 17th and 18th centuries. Fortunately, Wyeth's design for the McVeigh family survives in excellent original condition. There are stained glass windows which keep the light low, and a profusion of stained glass plaques, and the tapestries that cover the walls are reputedly woven by the Gobelin Works in France.
You know, this room, you walk into this room, and I always say it on the radio, I don't know, I felt smarter when I walked into this room with all these sculptures and books. It was like a place you just wanted to study. Uh-huh. And you know, and I think that really kind of connected to the place you want to hang out and read. It's a great room. Well, you know, the whole mansion is an amazing, luxurious hangout, and the Americans did it first, and then the Mexicans alike. So the wonderful paintings that are in the mansion, they're old and modern, and they embellish the walls, and it's kind of, they're very special, and Roberto Cuerva del Rio did the conservatory, which in 1941, which was a revamped room, and the entire room is airy and bright, and it's filled with light and these tiles inspired by the Puebla Talavera style. This is what was one of my favorite rooms in the whole place. And these tiles were made in the state of Puebla and in several cities in that state, like Talavera, and they were ceramics that are usually blue and ivory in color traditionally. The ceramics were made there since the 16th century in that part of Mexico in the form of majolica, mayolica, however you want to pronounce that, earthenware pottery, which were brought by the Spanish. The church and monasteries in the area were supporters of this industry for centuries. Important guilds arose, and the style is kind of a mixture of styles from Italy, Spain, and Mexico. So you get that kind of glue of culture in that room. The tiles also represent towards the ceiling the 31 states of Mexico. You know, I had no idea how many states there were in Mexico. Totally did not know that. And this is a really beautiful room in the mansion. I mean, they have this little, like, kind of like a little, I don't know if it's like a sink or a kind of a, it's, there's noise from dripping water in a kind
or
of sink.
Or a baptismal font.
Yeah, I mean, it's just yes. Amazing.
Yeah.
I had fun. I could have hung out there all day, actually.
Yeah. And the music room, which is facing 16th Street, and it spans the house's entire width, And its magnificent original decorations are intact. That's something about this house. It is beautiful condition. The painted decorative panels on the lower half of the walls copy the Salle de Garde at Roi de Chateau Fontainebleau. And they had permission to copy them, which is an unusual thing I didn't know you could do. It's like you are able to copy works of art and put them other places if you have authorization to do that by the Department of Monuments in France.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I didn't know it. The ornamentation on the upper walls is painted on burlap, and that's probably because the acoustics are softer. And so on the upper walls, the design is freer. And Wyatt, the architect, he surely designed the gentle curve of the cove ceilings with its shallow arches to enhance further the quality of the music in this room. They had an organ, which was an unusual musical instrument in a private house. You can imagine. His kids waking up to the organ. And it suggested that the McFays particularly favored 16th century music. The music room's elegant semi-elliptical stone and composite chimney piece that rises the full length of the room was inspired by French architectural traditions of the same era. The colors in this room are muted, French blue and gold. It's lovely.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It really is. Well, there are some slight remnants of the dominant Mexican Catholic past in the building. And there's what looks like a remnant of some ecclesiastical retablo altarpiece, but I'm not sure. And it's the minute you walk in on the left. It's a truly magnificent and kind of awesome sculpture. I did not see a label for it, but it's a stunning example of Mexican iconography that might have appeared behind an altar of a church somewhere, close to the ceiling. And looks like there's a few missing pieces that have been replaced possibly by mirrors. But the gold sculptures of holy people like the Virgin Mary and saints is very well done. And there's some also early 20th century paintings that echo the Catholic past in paint. Large canvases depicting the pomp and circumstances of high church and art and architecture, which I kind of like those kind of paintings. And they're also there in the building.
Yeah, well, the house was designed as a home, and some home. And the third floor is the family living quarters, but it's not cut off from the rest of the house. There's a very generous staircase that leads you up there. You don't feel like you're entering to a locked-away private place, but there's a flow that leads you up there. The McVays loved large dinner parties with musical interludes, and I forgot to look and find out where the servants' quarters were because they're surely not in view, but probably way back in the house.
Size mansion. Well, one of the important things about the Mexican Cultural Institute, is that it houses contemporary art as well. And there's an exhibition currently that unfortunately ends today, and it's titled A Dark and Scandalous Rockfall. The concept for the exhibition deals with Mexican-American border relations, a topic that is centuries old and has recently been thrust hugely into the news with topics of immigration, DACA, and border security. So it's kind of a hot topic in the arts as well. The exhibition highlights Mexican artist Perla Krause and American artist, which also a D.C. artist, Barbara Liotta. The title of the exhibition is drawn from a poem titled Dry Rain by the Mexican poet Serrano. It's a very lovely poem. Unfortunately, the exhibition ends today, but it has kind of art materials like stone slabs, strings, pieces of stone, and these charcoal rubbings, which are called frottage, to create figures and spaces that are stacked and suspended. The works are carefully placed in the spaces along walls and the floors and suspended in the center of the gallery spaces. There is some lovely artwork scattered in these stately rooms throughout the mansion. Some traditional works of seascapes and landscapes are also there. Artwork that caught my eye was a contemporary artist named Jesus Jimenez, who created these digital photo prints titled Dala Composition. I found these very fun. They're clean, digitally manipulated prints of money that seem to float in a space as a form, somewhat helical and infinite. They're kind of reminiscent of the infinite tessellations of Escher to me. I kind of went to Escher when I saw those. Some of our listeners might be familiar with M.C. Escher, the Swiss genius. And I think I got it. You know, aha, my kind of light went on when I was looking at these works. And it says, money makes the world go round in a kind of infinite way, in a circulation, the solar system, it never stops. I like the concept, and the digital prints are quite beautiful.
So at the Mexican Cultural Institute, there's an exhibition celebrating the 50th anniversary of those 1968 Olympic Games that Tom was talking about before, and it's titled Constructing Mexico 68, and it takes the audiences through a simple and concrete exploration of the sporting venues built in Mexico City and their constant connection to design and urban art. The competition sites for the events required adaptations of existing structures as well as rapid construction of new modern functional facilities. So the exhibit shows us the architectural innovation that was developed, like the smashing sports arena, the Ruta de Amistad, which is the the place of friendship that played a fundamental role in the Mexico 1968 games. The Root of Friendship consists of 22 large-scale sculptures. It is also so good to be reminded of the sporting events that took place in Mexico City. It was a controversial choice because of the city's high altitude of 7,500 feet. The altitude proved an advantage in explosive events such as short distance running, jumping, throwing, and weightlifting, but the rarefied air proved disastrous for those competing in endurance events. It was very controversial what these records being set should be sustained.
Right, yeah, that's right. Well, I opened the show about the introduction of culture in our lives, and I mentioned the 1968 Summer Olympic Games, and it certainly was an introduction for me about Mexico. At the Cultural Institute, this exhibit, Constructing Mexico 68, will be up till August 31st, and the exhibition is mostly photographs and documents of the constructions of the sporting venues and the connection to art and design. I think that's really important in the Mexican tradition. The exhibition visually documents the modern innovations and timely functional constructions of pre-existing structures, and that was important as the applications of architecture in the sporting events at that time being encompassed in the landscape was kind of innovative at that time. And the photos are actually neat from the 60s. You know, you get these dated photos, which really sometimes we like to look at old photos. The gallery space for the exhibition is quite lovely and extensive. It was enjoyable for me personally to revisit that Mexico Summer Olympics, which really, as a child, left a mark.
Yeah. So, as I stated in my four scattered experience, my very limited knowledge of Mexico, which was a movie, a divorce, and a couple of family trips, it made me not want to tackle this show. But every show we do is an opportunity to learn new things, and this really was no exception. So since you're stuck with what most interests me, and Tom's and my journey into artist experience, we encourage all of you to have your own journeys and in this way enrich your lives, because this show really enriched my life. And especially with our current precarious relationship with our old friends and allies, Mexico, visiting the cultural center makes Mexico come alive for me. And it reminds me of the rich stuff that we get. I didn't even mention tequila and margaritas and tacos and all the fabulous things that are in our lives on a daily basis.
Well, yeah, culture is also culinary, and I think that's an important thing. And most of us, you know, might have our route to Mexico through that, through our stomachs and our palates. Well, the Mexican Cultural Institute is a very special place. Today, in fact, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, is a great opportunity to visit, as the passport to the embassies has the Cultural Institute open from the public from 10 to 4, and it's free. if you have a photo ID, some embassies require a photo ID upon entrance. You can go to the Mexican Cultural Institute website and the Cultural Tourism DC website and see more what's happening today at the Mexican Cultural Institute. There'll be a dance troupe there, Corazón Folklórico, at 11 a.m., 1 and 3 p.m. That sounds very exciting. Coincidentally, the Cinco de Mayo will have other things at the Mexican Cultural Institute that will be festive and welcoming. Sheila and I would like to thank Alberto Fierro, the Executive Director of the Mexican Cultural Institute and Minister of Education and Culture, for being so gracious to meet us and take the time to introduce us to this very special place in D.C. I believe education and enlightenment are the keys to understanding peoples that are different from ourselves. Exposure and engagement to humanity brings people together, and these can rid prejudices and bigotry that often are fueled by emotional, physical isolation and ignorance. The cultural depth and richness of Mexico are beautifully shared at the Mexican Cultural Institute, and we invite you all to experience this hidden gem in the heart of D.C. The visual arts are just one part of this engaging institution. There's a lot of things going on in music, film, literature, and the performing arts. We invite you to experience the visual, experience art in everything you do. We hope you enjoyed the show. Sheila, tell us about our upcoming exciting show.
Yeah, actually, I can't wait to do this show. There's at the National Gallery of Art, there's a new exhibition of Paul Cézanne portraits, which are not his. This is a very unusual show because his portraits are usually considered sort of secondary, but they've gotten all of these secondary in his work, which is mostly landscapes and still lifes. But this exhibition goes through July 1st, so if you listen, you'll really be psyched to go see it. It's important, and it's a must-see for Tom and me. So we're excited to do a show on this great modern master. I've been twice already, and there's so much to think about.
Yeah, it's a blockbuster exhibition, and we're going to do a blockbuster show, we promise. Please go online. We have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to donate and also buy these really handsome T-shirts for Tacoma Radio, and it's lovely. They're reasonably priced, and you can purchase and walk around Tacoma Park and beyond and be wowed and be proud with a handsome shirt. Thank you so much, and thanks for listening. Have a great day.
son